Chapter 5. I am of a good age to be enlisted at the outbreak of the Second World War, and yet, for my first few lives, managed somehow to avoid all the dramatic moments of conflict which I would later read about from the comfort of the 1980s. In my first life, I enlisted of my own volition, genuinely believing the three great fallacies of the time: that the war would be brief, that the war would be patriotic, and that the war would advance me in my skills. I missed being embarked for France by 4 days, and felt deeply disappointed in myself that I had not been evacuated from Dunkirk, which at the time seemed like a very triumphant defeat. Indeed, the first year of my war seemed to be spent on perpetual training exercises, first on the beaches as the nation, myself included, waited for an invasion that didn't come, then in the mountains of Scotland as the government began to toy with retribution. Indeed, I spent so much time training for an invasion of Norway that by the time it was finally decided that the exercise would be futile, I and my unit were accounted of such little use in desert warfare that we were held back from the initial embarkation to the Mediterranean theatre until we could be retrained or something else worked out useful for us to do. In this sense, I suppose I achieved one of my ambitions, as, with no one seeming to want us to fight, I found myself with nothing better to do than study and learn. A medic in our unit was an objector who had found his conscience in the works of Engels and the poetry of Wilfred Owen, and who all the men in the unit, myself included, considered a weak-chinned toff, until the day he stood up to the sergeant, who had enjoyed his power too long and too much, and in front of all the men lambasted him as the slobbering perversion of a childhood bully that he was. The medic's name was Valkeith, and he received 3 days' confinement for his outburst, and the respect of all. His learning, previously a source of much derision, now became something of an object of pride, and though he was still cursed as a weak-chinned toff, now he was our weak-chinned toff, and from his mind I began to learn some of the mysteries of science, philosophy, and romantic poetry, none of which I would admit to at the time. He died 3 minutes and 50 seconds after we set foot on the beaches of Normandy, from a shrapnel wound which tore open his gut. He was the only one of our unit who died that day, for we were far from the action, and the gun which fired the fatal shot was taken 2 minutes later. In my first life, I killed 3 men. They were all together, all of them at once, in a tank retreating in a village in northern France. We'd been told that the village was already liberated, that there would be no resistance. But there it was, sat between the bakery and the church, like a horsefly on a slice of melon. We'd been so relaxed we didn't even notice it until the barrel swung round towards us like the eye of a muddy crocodile, and its jaws released the shell that killed 2 of us outright, and young Tommy Kenner 3 days later in his hospital bed. I remember my actions with the same clarity with which I recall all else, and they were these: to drop my rifle, to unsling my bag, and to run, never ceasing in my shout, down the middle of the street, still screaming at the tank that had killed my friends. I hadn't done the strap-up on my helmet, and it fell off my head some 10 yards from the front of the tank. I could hear men moving around inside that beast as I approached, see faces darting through the slits in the armour as they tried to swing the gun round towards me or get onto the machine guns, but I was already there. The main gun was hot. Even from a foot away I could feel its warmth on my face. I dropped a grenade through the open front hatch. I could hear them shouting, scrambling around inside, trying to get it. But in that confined space, they only made it worse. I remember my actions, but not my thoughts. Later, the captain said that the tank must have got lost. Their friends had turned left, and they'd turned right, and that was why they'd killed 3 of us, and been killed in return. I was given a medal, which I sold in 1961, when I needed to pay for a new boiler, and I felt a great relief once it was gone. That was my first war. I did not volunteer for my second. I knew it likely that I would soon be conscripted, so chose to rely on skills learned in my first life to keep myself alive. In my third life, I joined the RAF as a ground mechanic and ran for the shelter faster than any other man in my squad when the sirens went, until finally Hitler began to bomb London, and I knew I could begin to relax. It was a good place to be for the first few years. The men who died, nearly all died in the air, out of sight and out of mind. The pilots did not really interact with us greasemen, and I found it all too easy to consider the plane my only care, and the man who flew it merely another mechanical part to be ignored and overcome. Then the Americans came, and we began bombing Germany, and many more men died in the air, where I only needed to lament the loss of their machines. But more began coming back, shot through with shrapnel, their blood on the floor just thick enough to retain the shape of the footprints that had scrambled through it. I wondered what I could do differently with my knowledge of what was to come, and concluded that it was nothing. I knew that the Allies would win, but had never studied the Second World War in any academic detail. My knowledge was entirely personal, a thing lived rather than information to be shared. The most I could do was warn a man in Scotland by the name of Valkeith to stay in the boat 2 minutes longer on the beach of Normandy, or whisper to Private Kenner that there would be a tank in the village of Genemont, which had turned right instead of left and was waiting between the bakery and the church to end his days. But I had no strategic information to impart, no learning or knowledge other than a declaration that Citroën would make elegant, unreliable cars, and one day people would look back at the division of Europe and wonder why. Having reasoned myself so eloquently into this position, I continued once again to have a thoroughly unremarkable war. I oiled the landing gear of the planes which would destroy Dresden. I heard rumours of boffins attempting to design a jet engine and how the engineers derided the notion. I listened for the moment that the engines of the V1s stopped, and, for a brief period, for the silence of a V2 that had already fallen. And when VE Day came, I got horrendously drunk on brandy, which I don't particularly like, with a Canadian and two Welshmen, who I'd met only 2 days before and who I never saw again. And I learned. This time, I learned. I learned of engines and machines, of men and strategies, of the RAF and the Luftwaffe. I studied bomb patterns, observed where the missiles had fallen, so that next time, for I felt 60% confident that there would be a next time, all this again, I would have something more useful to serve myself with, and potentially others, than a few personal recollections about the quality of tinned ham in France. As it was, the same knowledge which protected me from the world was, in later times, also to put me in great danger, and by this route, indirectly introduce me to the Cronus Club, and the Cronus Club to me.